My Blind Husband. Chapter 51. Joy sorry, the ring at the door was a parcel for upstairs and we always sign for each other, so that's where I've been. Sometimes, if I know Joanna is sending me flowers, I pretend not to be in, just so a neighbor picks them up and sees them. Terrible of me, really, but I'm sure people do worse. Anyway, Bernard was saying that he wouldn't take orders from the police. Bernard was staying put and that was that. Ron said that he'd once been chained to a pit shaft in Glashütten for 48 hours and they'd had to defecate into sandwich bags, though he didn't say defecate, and that was when Father Mackey introduced himself. I had seen him at the meeting. He had sat at the back, quiet as you please, and slipped biscuits into his pocket when he thought no one was looking. As I've said, no one ever realizes I'm watching. I just have one of those faces. I have to say he was very polite and he thanked us for protecting the garden. Bernard told him the garden was only the start of it and once you give someone an inch, then we all know what they'd take. Ron then had to have his say and told Father Mackey that his lot, the Catholics, had not always been squeaky clean when it came to graveyards, but that a liberty is still a liberty and he didn't like to see one being taken. Father Mackey said that wouldn't happen on my watch and it all got a bit cowboy film, which was fine by me. I like to see men being men, up to a point. This is when Ventham must have caught sight of Father Mackey, because over he rushes, with Chris, Donna and I Ibrahim chasing behind. And so, the stage was now set. Chapter 52. Bogdan has been digging for a long time. Why not? Might as well be getting something done. He started at the very top of the Garden of Eternal Rest, where the earliest graves are now permanently under the shadow of the wide branches of the trees behind the wall. The ground is softer, with no sunlight in many years, and Bogdan knows that the older, grander coffins here will be intact. They will be solid oak. They won't be split or rotten. There will be no skulls staring up at him, hollow and eaten and hopeful. He hears the odd bit of excitement from down the hill, but still no rumble of the low loader, and so he keeps digging. One of the machines could uncover a whole row of graves in minutes, especially if not much care is taken, which Bogdan knows will be the case. So he chooses to be neat and tidy, for as long as it is just him and his shovel. The next grave he chooses to tackle is tucked tightly in the top corner of the graveyard. As he digs, he is thinking about Marina, the woman he met on his way up here. He has seen her before in the village, but mainly people don't talk to him, they don't even notice him, and that's okay. He doesn't suppose you are allowed to visit people here, but maybe one day if he bumped into her again, then that would be okay. He misses his mother some days. Bogdan's shovel finally strikes something solid, but it is not the lid of the coffin. There are many stones and tree roots, which make the job harder, but more fun, for Bogdan. He reaches down and clears thick earth off the obstruction. It is pure white. Beautiful, in fact, thinks Bogdan, in the moment before he realizes what it is. This was not part of Bogdan's plan. The very point of digging here was that there would be no rotten coffins and no bones. And yet here they were. So even 150 years ago they were cutting corners. Cheap coffins, who would ever find out? Should he just fill the grave back in? Pretend it never happened and wait for the diggers? Something about that makes him feel uncomfortable. Bogdan has uncovered a bone and that makes him the guardian. He has no smaller tool than the shovel with him, so kneels down on the compacted earth and starts to work with his hands alone. He is as gentle as he can be. He shifts his kneeling weight to get a better angle to clear away more dirt, and as he does so he realizes he is not kneeling on compacted dirt but on something much more solid. He realizes that he is kneeling on the solid oak lid of the solid oak coffin. Which can't be. A body can't escape from a coffin. Bogdan tries to force out a horrific thought. Had someone been buried alive? Had they managed to somehow clamber out of the coffin, but no further? Bogdan works quickly, with no room for ceremony or superstition. There are many bones and then a skull, though he tries not to disturb it. He uncovers enough of the coffin to jam the blade of his shovel under the lid. After considerable effort, he breaks open the lower third. Inside is another skeleton. Two skeletons. One inside the coffin and one outside. One small, one big. One gray and yellow, one cloud white. What to do? Somebody should take a look at it, that was fairly certain. Though that would take a long time. They would dig with tiny trowels, Bogdan had seen it on TV. And they wouldn't just be digging into this grave, they would be digging into all of them. And Bogdan knows it will end up being nothing. It will just be how they used to bury people in this country, or one year there was a disease and they buried people together, or a million other possibilities. Meanwhile, the development will be delayed and he will be waiting to work. So, the question remains. What to do? Bogdan needs thinking time, but unfortunately he doesn't have that luxury. In the distance, Bogdan hears a siren. He waits a moment and the siren comes closer. It sounds like an ambulance to Bogdan, but he knows, logically, that it must be the police. Which means the barricade will be clear soon enough and the circus will begin. Bogdan hauls himself out of the grave and starts to fill it in once more. Ian will tell me what to do, he thinks, as the sirens reach the bottom of the path. Chapter 53. Ian Ventham, exiting the police car, is calm, happy even. The police have had a placatory chat with him. He'll come back tomorrow. The graves aren't going anywhere. Perhaps sending in the diggers so early was a mistake. But it was a cool thing to do, so a mistake worth making. It was a statement, and making statements is important, whatever they are. He doesn't mind the residents being up in arms, they'll soon lose interest. He can just give them something else to complain about. Sack one of the waiting staff that they like, or ban grandkids from the pool on health and safety grounds. Then they'll be all what graveyard. He has to laugh, really, and so he does. But, at that very moment, he sees Father Matthew Mackey. Standing there in his frock and little white collar, like he owns the place. As bold as you like. This is Ian's land, for Christ's sake. It's Ian's property. He storms towards the barricade, and has his finger in Father Mackey's face in seconds. If you weren't a vicar, I would knock you out. The crowd starts to surround them, like a fight in a pub car park. Get off my property, or I'll get you thrown off. Ian aims a shove at Mackey's shoulder, knocking the older man backwards. Mackey reaches out for balance, grabbing Ian's t-shirt, and the two men lose their balance and fall to the ground together. Donna, with the help of a horrified-looking Karen Playfair, pulls Ian up and off the priest. A group of residents, including Joyce, Ron, and Bernard, then surround and restrain Ian Ventham while a group of residents on the other side form a guard around Father Mackey, now sitting, dazed, on the ground. School playground really, but he looks shaken. Calm it, Mr. Ventham, calm down, yells Donna. Arrest him. Trespass, yells Ian, now being pulled away from the scene by a group of determined septuagenarians, octogenarians, and even one nonagenarian, who had missed Second World War call-up by a day and has regretted it ever since. Joyce finds herself in the scrum. How strong these men must have been in their time, Ron, Bernard, John, Ibrahim. And how diminished they were now. The spirit was still willing at least, but only Chris Hudson was really able to hold Ventham back. The testosterone was lovely while it lasted though. I'm protecting sacred ground. Peacefully and lawfully, says Father Mackey. Donna helps Father Mackey to his feet, dusting him down and feeling the frailty of the old man beneath the loose black cassock. Chris pulls Ian Ventham from the scrum of bodies surrounding him. He can see the adrenaline surging through Ventham's body, the sort of thing he's seen a thousand times before, in the late-night drunks of too many towns. The veins riding the muscles that poke out from his t-shirt, a giveaway of steroid abuse. Home now, Mr. Ventham, orders Chris Hudson, before I arrest you. I didn't touch him, protests Ian Ventham. Chris remains quiet, to keep the conversation private. He stumbled, Mr. Ventham, I saw that, but he stumbled after you made contact with him, however light. So if I want to arrest you I will. And, allow a policeman a hunch, there might be one or two witnesses to help me in court. So, if you don't want to be charged with assaulting a priest, which wouldn't look good in your brochures, then you get in your car and you drive away. Understand? Ian Ventham nods, but without conviction, his brain already somewhere else, making some other calculation. He then shakes his head, slowly and sadly, at Chris Hudson. Something's not right here. Something's up. Well, whatever's up will still be up tomorrow, says Chris. So get yourself home, calm yourself down and mop your brow. Be a man and take a defeat. Ian turns and walks towards his car. Defeat. As if. As he passes the low loader he bangs twice on the cab door and cocks his thumb towards the exit. He walks slowly, thinking. Where's Bogdan? Bogdan is a good guy. He's Polish. He needs to get Bogdan to tile his swimming pool. He's too lazy, they all are. He'll talk to Tony Curran. Tony will know what to do. But did Tony lose his phone? Something about Tony. Ian reaches the Range Rover. The car has been clamped. His dad will be furious, he's only borrowed it. He'll have to get the bus from town and his dad will be waiting for him. Ian is frightened and starts to cry. Don't cry, Ian, he'll see. Ian doesn't want to go home. He searches his pockets for change, then stumbles and topples backwards. He reaches out for something to hold onto, but, to his surprise, there is only air. Ian Ventham is dead before he hits the ground. Chapter 54. Joyce, I tripped over a loose paving slab in Fairhaven a few weeks ago. I didn't mention it in my diary because of murders and trips to London and my pursuit of Bernard. But it was a nasty tumble and I dropped my bag and my things went everywhere. Keys, glasses case, pills, phone. Now, here's the thing. Every single person who saw me fall came over to help. Every single one of them. A cyclist helped me to my feet, a traffic warden picked up my things and dusted down my bag, a lady with a pushchair sat with me at a pavement table until I'd got my breath back. The woman who ran the cafe came out with a cup of tea and offered to drive me around to her GP. Perhaps they only came to help because I look old. I look frail and helpless. But I don't think so. I think I would have helped if I saw a fit youngster take the tumble I did. I think you would too. I think I would have sat with him, I think the traffic warden would have picked up his laptop and I think the woman in the cafe would still have offered to drive him to her GP. That's who we are as human beings. For the most part, we are kind. However, I still remember a consultant I once worked with, at Brighton General, up on the hill. A very rude, very cruel, very unhappy man, and he made our lives a misery. He would shout and would blame us for mistakes he made. Now, if that consultant had dropped dead in front of my eyes I would have danced a jig. You mustn't speak ill of the dead, I know, but there are exceptions to every rule and Ian Ventham was of the same type as this consultant. Come to think of it, he was called Ian too, so that's something to look out for. You know those people. People who feel the world is theirs alone? They say you see it more and more these days, this selfishness, but some people were always awful. Not many, that's what I'm saying, but always a few. All of which is to say that, in one way, I'm sorry that Ian Ventham is dead, but there is another way to look at it. On any given day lots of people die. I don't know the statistics, but it must be thousands. So somebody was going to die yesterday and I'm just saying that I would rather it was Ian Ventham who died in front of me than, say, the cyclist or the traffic warden, or the mum with the pushchair, or the woman who ran the cafe. I would rather it was Ian Ventham the paramedics failed to save, than that it was Joanna, or Elizabeth. Or Ron, or Ibrahim, or Bernard. Without wanting to sound selfish about it, I would rather it was Ian Ventham who was zipped into a bag and wheeled into a coroner's van, than me. For Ian Ventham, though, yesterday was the day. We will all have one and yesterday was his. Elizabeth says he was killed, and if Elizabeth says he was killed then I expect he was. I don't suppose he expected that when he woke up yesterday morning. I hope I don't sound callous, it's just that I have seen a lot of people die and I have shed so many tears. But I have shed none for Ian Ventham and I just wanted you to know why. It is sad that he is dead, but it hasn't made me sad. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go and help solve his murder. Chapter 55. Well, here's the big headline. Chris Hudson is standing at the front of the briefing room, his team spread out in front of him. Ian Ventham was murdered. Donna De Freitas looks around at the murder squad. There are a few new faces. She simply cannot believe her luck. Two murders and here she is, right in the middle of it all. She had to hand it to Elizabeth. She definitely owed her a drink, or whatever else Elizabeth might prefer. A scarf? Who knew what Elizabeth would like? A gun, probably. Chris opens a folder. Ian Ventham's death was caused by fentanyl poisoning. A massive overdose, delivered into the muscle of his upper arm. Almost certainly in the moments leading up to his collapse. You'll tell by the speed that this is not official, this is me calling in a favor, okay. And they see enough fentanyl overdoses at the path lab these days to know one when they see one. We're the only people who have that piece of information at present, so let's keep it that way as long as we can, please. No press, no friends, and family. He gives Donna the briefest of looks. Chapter 56. So, we were all witnesses to a murder, says Elizabeth. Which, needless to say, is wonderful. 15 winding miles away, the Thursday Murder Club is in extraordinary session. Elizabeth is laying out a series of full-color photos of the corpse of Ian Ventham, alongside every conceivable angle of the scene. She had taken them on her phone while pretending she was calling for an ambulance. She then had them privately printed by a chemist in Robertsbridge who owed her a favor, due to her keeping quiet about a criminal conviction from the 1970s that she had managed to uncover. Tragic too, in its way, if we wanted to be traditional about our emotions, adds Ibrahim. Yes, if we wanted to be melodramatic, Ibrahim, says Elizabeth. First question, then, says Ron. How do you know it was a murder? Looked like a heart attack to me. And you're a doctor, Ron, asks Elizabeth. As much as you are, Liz, says Ron. Elizabeth opens a folder and takes out a sheet of paper. Well, Ron, I've already been over this with Ibrahim, because I had a job for him, but listen carefully. The cause of death was an overdose of fentanyl, administered very shortly before death. This information is straight from a man who has access to the email correspondence of the Kent Police Forensic Service, but it hasn't yet been confirmed by Donna, even though I have texted her repeatedly. Happy, Ron. Ron nods. Yeah, I'll give you that. What's fentanyl? That's a new one on me. It's an opioid, Ron, like heroin, says Joyce. They use it in anesthesia, pain relief, all sorts of things. Very effective, patients rave about it. Also you can mix it with cocaine, says Ibrahim. If you were a drug addict, say. And the Russian security services use it for all sorts of things, says Elizabeth. Ron nods, satisfied. Ibrahim says, and, as it must have been administered very shortly before his death, then we are all suspects in his murder. Joyce claps her hands. Splendid. I'm not sure how any of us would have got hold of fentanyl, but splendid. She is arranging Viennese whirls on a plate commemorating Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding, something Joanna had assumed she would like many years ago. Ron is nodding, looking at the photos of the scene. Looking at the faces of the residents craning for a better view of Ian Ventham's slumped body. So, someone at Cooper's Chase killed him? Someone in these pictures. And we are all in the pictures, says Ibrahim. Except for Elizabeth, of course, says Joyce. Because she was taking the photos. But she would still be a suspect for any half-decent investigation. I would hope so, agrees Elizabeth. Ibrahim walks over to a flip chart. Elizabeth asked me to make a few calculations. Elizabeth, Joyce, and Ron settle into the jigsaw room chairs. Ron takes a Viennese whirl, to the relief of Joyce, who now feels able to do the same. They are own brand, but there had been a Greg Wallace program which had said they were made in the same factory as the proper ones. Ibrahim begins. Somebody in that crowd administered an injection to Ian Ventham which killed him, almost certainly within a minute. There was a puncture wound found on his upper arm. I asked you all to compile a list of everybody you remembered seeing, which you kindly did, although not all of your lists were alphabetized in the way I had asked. Ibrahim looks at Ron. Ron shrugs. Honestly, I get mixed up somewhere around F, H, and G and then I give up. Ibrahim continues. If we combine those lists, an easy job if you know your way around an Excel spreadsheet, then in total there were 64 residents at the scene, ourselves included. Then we add DCI Hudson and PC DeFreitas, the builder Bogdan, who went missing, he was up on the hill, says Elizabeth. Thank you, Elizabeth, says Ibrahim. We add the driver of the low loader whose name was Marie, another poll if that is of interest. She also teaches yoga, but that's by the by. Karen Playfair, the lady who lives at the top of the hill, was there, as she was supposed to teach us about computers yesterday. And then, of course, Father Matthew Mackey. That makes 70, Ibrahim, says Ron, now onto his second biscuit, whatever diabetes might say. And Ian Ventham makes 71, explains Ibrahim. So you think he might have driven up, started a ruck, then killed himself? All right, Poirot, says Ron. This isn't thinking, Ron, says Ibrahim. This is just a list. So no impatience, please. Impatience is all I got, says Ron. It's my superpower. You know Arthur Scargill once told me to be patient? Arthur Scargill. So one of these 70 people killed Ian Ventham. Now these are nicer odds than the Thursday Murder Club usually faces, but can we narrow down the field still further? It would have to be someone with access to needles and drugs, suggests Joyce. That's everyone here, Joyce, says Elizabeth. Quite so, Elizabeth, agrees Ibrahim. If I might be permitted a visual image, that would be like looking for a needle in a haystack made entirely of needles. Ibrahim pauses, under the assumption there might be applause at this point. In its absence, he continues. Now, the injection would be the work of a split second to anyone experienced in intramuscular injections, which, again, is all of us. But the drug would need to be administered at very close quarters. So, I have deleted the names of anyone we know, for a fact, was never in close proximity to Ian Ventham. That loses a lot of the supporting cast. The fact that many of the crowd suffer from severe mobility issues has played into our hands here, as we know they couldn't have managed a quick dash when none of us were looking. No Zimmers, agrees Ron. We lose 8 names on Zimmer frames alone, agrees Ibrahim. Mobility scooters are also our friends here, as are cataracts. There are also many people, such as Stephen, I hope you agree, Elizabeth, who never found themselves close to Ian Ventham on that morning. They are struck from the list. Also, 3 residents were padlocked to the gate until someone thought to call the fire brigade, sometime later in the day. And so here we find ourselves. Ibrahim turns over the top sheet of the flip chart to reveal a list of names. 30 names. Ourselves included. And one of them is the killer. I pause only to note that, alphabetically, by surname, I am first on the list. Well done, Ibrahim, says Joyce. So that's the list, says Elizabeth. And I'm guessing it's now time for the thinking. Yes, I think between us we can trim down the list a little further, says Ibrahim. Who wanted him dead, says Ron. Who gained? Did the same person kill Curran and Ventham? Funny to think, isn't it, says Joyce, wiping crumbs from the front of her blouse. That we know a murderer? I mean, we don't know who it is, but we know we definitely know one. It's brilliant, agrees Ron. He is considering Biscuit 3, but knows there's no way he would get away with it. Well, we had better get started, says Ibrahim. Conversational French are due in at 12. Chapter 57. Which means, says Chris Hudson, that the fentanyl must have been administered by someone who was there that morning. So, one way or another, we already know our killer. Today, we work on a full list of everyone who was there, which won't be easy, but the sooner we have it, the sooner we'll have the killer. And who knows, maybe Tony Curran's killer too. Unless Ventham killed Curran and this was retaliation. Donna chances a quick peek out of the briefing room window. Her uniformed colleague, Mark, is putting on a bicycle helmet, perfectly complementing his morose expression. Donna sips her tea, murder squad tea, and thinks about suspects. She thinks about Father Mackey. What do they really know about him? Then she thinks about the Thursday murder club. They were all there. All surrounding Ventham at one point or another. She could imagine them each, in their own particular way, being a murderer. Hypothetically, anyway. But actually, she couldn't see it. They would certainly have a view, though. Donna should probably head over and see them. In the meantime, continues Chris, opening another folder, I have some other fun jobs for you. Ian Ventham was not a popular man. His business dealings were complicated and wide-reaching, and his phone has revealed a list of affairs, which must have been pretty tiring for him. Tell your loved ones they won't be seeing much of you for a while. Loved ones. Donna thinks about her ex, Carl, then realizes she hasn't thought about Carl for a good 48 hours, which is a new record. Though she has thought about him now, which spoils it a little. She realizes, though, that soon she won't think about him for 96 hours, and then a week, and before you know it Carl will just seem like a character from a book she once read. Really, why had she left London? What happens when these murders are solved and she's back in uniform? And the rest of you, no let up on the Tony Curran case. The two could be connected, we can't rule it out. We still need the speed camera info. I particularly want to know if Ian Ventham's car was on that road that afternoon. I need to know where Bobby Tanner is and I need to know who took that photograph. And I still need the information on the phone number that called Curran. Which reminds Donna of a little hunch she has been meaning to check. Chapter 58. Elizabeth is back in Willows, sitting in her low chair in Penny's room. She is filling Penny in on the drama. Simply everyone was there. Penny. You would have been in your element, swinging your truncheon and arresting everyone in sight, no doubt. Elizabeth looks over at John, in the chair where he spends most of his waking hours. I'm guessing you filled Penny in on the details, John. John nods. I may have overstated my own bravery a little, but other than that, it was. Chapter and verse. Elizabeth, satisfied, pulls a notepad and ballpoint from her handbag. She taps a page of the notepad with her pen, like a conductor giving notice to her orchestra, and begins. So, where are we, Penny? Tony Curran is bludgeoned to death, by person, or persons, unknown. As a side note, I will never tire of saying bludgeoned. I bet you used to say that a lot in the police, you lucky thing. Now Ian Ventham, meanwhile, dies within seconds of being injected with a huge dose of fentanyl. You know fentanyl, John?
Of course, says John. Used it all the time.
Anesthetic, mainly.
John the vet.
Elizabeth remembers the fox that John nursed back to health with Ron. Once healthy, it had gone on to murder Elaine McCausland's chickens. Not proven, but there were no other suspects. Ron had taken a lot of grief for it at the time, which had pleased him enormously. How easy would it be to get hold of it, asks Elizabeth.
For someone here.
John starts. Well, not easy, but not impossible. Pharmacies would have it. You could break in here, I suppose, but you'd have to be very determined, or very lucky. And you can get it on the internet.
Goodness, says Elizabeth.
Can you?
The dark web.
I read about it in The Lancet.
You can get all sorts.
A rocket launcher, if you really wanted one.
Elizabeth nods.
And how would one go about getting on the dark web?
John shrugs.
Well, I'm guessing, but if it were me, the first thing I would do would be to buy a computer.
Perhaps go from there.
Says Elizabeth. Might be worth checking who has a computer.
You never know, agrees John.
It would certainly narrow it down.
Elizabeth turns back to Penny.
How unfair to see her lying there.
One man bludgeoned, Penny, the other poisoned.
But by whom?
If Ventham was killed straight away, then somebody out there this morning killed him.
Me or John.
Or Ron or Ibrahim.
Or, who knows?
Ibrahim has a list of 30 names on a spreadsheet, to start us off.
Elizabeth looks at her friend again. She wants to walk out of the door with her right now, arm in arm. Share a bottle of white, listen to her swear like a docker about some imagined slight and sway home happy and tipsy. But that will never happen again.
I always find it peculiar that Ibrahim doesn't come and visit you, Penny.
Oh, he does, says John.
Ibrahim visits, says Elizabeth.
He's never said.
Like clockwork, Elizabeth.
Every day he brings a magazine and solves bridge puzzles with her.
He talks them through.
They solve a puzzle, he kisses her hand and off he pops half an hour later.
And Ron, asks Elizabeth.
Does he visit?
Never, says John.
I suppose it's not for everyone, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth nods.
She supposes so too.
Back to business.
So, Penny, who wants to kill Ian Ventham?
And why at the very moment digging was about to start?
I suspect your question might be, who loses what if the development goes ahead?
Wouldn't you think?
I want to talk to you about Bernard Cottle at some point.
Do you remember him?
With the Daily Express and the nice wife?
I feel like there is a motive there, waiting to be winkled out.
Elizabeth stands, ready to leave.
Who loses what, Penny?
That's the question, isn't it?
Chapter 59.
Chris Hudson has his own office, a little bolt hole where he can pretend to work. There is a space on his desk where a family photograph might ordinarily sit and he feels a prick of shame every time he notes its absence.
Perhaps he should have a photo of his niece?
How old was she now?
12.
Or maybe 14.
His brother would know.
So who killed Ventham?
Chris was right there when it happened.
One way or another, he actually watched him being killed.
Who had he seen?
The Thursday Murder Club, they were all there, the priest. The attractive woman in the jumper and trainers.
Now who was she?
Was she single?
Now's not the time, Chris.
Concentrate.
Had the same person murdered Ventham and Tony Curran?
It made sense.
Solve one, solve the other?
Who were the three calls to Tony Curran's phone from?
Almost certainly someone trying to sell him life insurance, but you never knew. Chris is sure that Tony Curran's phone could tell all sorts of tales. Human rights are all well and good, but Chris would love to tap the phone of every single person in Fairhaven who looked even a bit suspicious. Like they do in prison. He remembers an armed robber called Bernie Scullion who ran out of money in Parkhurst, but wanted to buy himself a PlayStation, so phoned his uncle and told him where he'd buried £500,000. The police had the money and the uncle within the hour and Bernie never got his PlayStation. There is a knock at the door and Chris has the brief, disturbing, realization that he hopes it's Donna. Come. The door opens. It's de Terry Hallett. Terrifyingly efficient, handsome in that Royal Marine way that everyone seemed to like, but also, annoyingly, a nice guy. Chris would never be able to wear a t-shirt that tight. One day Terry will have this office. Terry has 4 kids and a happy marriage. Imagine the photographs he will have on the desk. Chris wishes he was Terry, but who really knew what went on at home? Perhaps Terry had a hidden sadness, perhaps he cried himself to sleep? Chris doubts it, but at least it's something to cling to. I can come back, says Terry, and Chris realizes he has been staring at him for a beat too long. No, no, sorry, Terry, miles away. Thinking about Ian Ventham. Yep, lies Chris. What have you got? Sorry to drag you back to Tony Curran, but I've got something I think you're going to like, says Terry. I've got a car that took 12 minutes to travel the half mile between the 2 speed cameras either side of Tony Curran's house. Exactly the right time frame too. Chris looks at the details. So it stopped somewhere between the two? Nice little 10-minute break for something or other. Terry Hallett nods. Anything else around there except Tony Curran's house? Somewhere you'd stop. There's a lay-by. If you needed a slash. But, long slash, agrees Chris. We've all had them, but even so. And you've run the number plate. Terry nods again. Then smiles. I like that smile, Terry. What have you got? You won't believe the registered owner, GUV. Terry slides another piece of paper onto Chris's desk. Chris takes it in. Well, this is very good news. Are you sure about these timings? Terry Hallett nods and drums his fingers on Chris's desk. That's our killer, surely. Chris has to agree. Time to go and have a chat. Chapter 60. Bogdan has seen where Marina lives, and now is as good a time as any. She will know what to do about the bones, he sensed that as soon as he met her. He has brought her flowers. Not from the shop but from the wood, tied the way his mother used to tie them. Flat 8. He presses the buzzer and a man's voice answers. This surprises Bogdan. He has kept a close eye on her for a while and not seen a man. The external door to the flat swings open. I am here for Marina? To see Marina, he says as he walks through. The first door off the carpeted hallway swings open and he sees an elderly man in pajamas running a comb through his thick, gray hair. Maybe he has got this wrong? Either way, the man will know Marina and can point him in the right direction. I come looking for Marina, says Bogdan. I think maybe she live here, but maybe another flat. Marina? Of course, come in, let's get the kettle on, shall we? Never too early, is it? Says Stephen. With an arm around his shoulder, the man ushers Bogdan in. Bogdan is relieved to see a picture of Marina, a younger Marina, on the hallway table. It's the right flat. I don't know where she is, old chap, but she won't be long, says Stephen. Probably at the shops or round at her mother's. Sit yourself down and let's make the most of the peace and quiet. You play chess at all?